Welcome to My Medieval Mayhem, the podcast where we discuss medieval literature, history, and medievalism. I'm Marcelo Osada, resident medieval scholar and educator, and with me is Jan Michael Osada, resident Burning Man lover and slinger of pork belly noodles, the nudes.
Oh, and, you know it. You know it. Hello, Internet. Good to be back.
And from what I understand, Jan, you're also winner in a Thunderdome.
Oh, true. I did take a life in the Thunderdome. And by a life, I think I just took someone's pride, which it's similar. In the medieval ages, it would have been the same thing.
It would have been very similar, yes. I believe he spanked a person with a sword, so good for you.
This could be true, yes.
Yeah. So, Jan, today I want to do a quick recap about the story that we're now embarking into the second edition, second part with, which is a British lay. Do you remember what a Breton lay is?
That was a type of clothing, right?
No, not so much. Okay. Yeah, okay. Swinging a miss on that one. But to sum it up, and here's an excerpt from the last thing that we discussed. The Breton lay may refer to any of the poems produced between approximately 1150 and 1450. So pretty big. 300 years.
Yep, range of time. Yep.
Which claimed to be literary versions of lays sung by ancient Britons to the accompaniment of the harp.
That's right. It's a harp jam. It's a little story. It's a concept album. It's a dream theater album, or pick whatever prog rock band you want to associate it with.
Yeah, and this one's butting up into the second third of that. So the story that we're looking at is Orfeo, not Oreo. That's a different story.
That is a type of cookie. Yes. Not a man.
Right. And this is from 1330s, 1340s. So pretty old, by our standards. It's about 700 years old. Almost.
Yeah, that's pretty old. Older than our nation. Yep. Yeah. Pretty old.
Yeah. Old. So, some different context here. There's two amazing editors that I have for you. Which I will put at the end, and they're in our last episode. What I want to go to is, do you remember, Jan, what has happened here?
I remember our homie Orfeo was up to no good. Not really. I don't remember exactly where
I was so off. Hoping you were going into a Fresh Prince version. Oh, it
was that, like, my brain was trying to connect those dots.
Oh, but, man, that would have been priceless. I don't think I could do it either on the fly, but yeah, that would have been cool. Yeah. So, but okay. Yeah.
I do not remember where exactly we were.
Okay. Do you remember what Orfeo is good at? What does he do well?
Harping. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. He's a minstrel, right? Yeah. Do you remember? Is he single? Is he?
No, he's got a lady.
Uh huh. Uh huh. Yeah. And so her name in this one is Herodotus.
Good old Herodotus.
Yeah. Although we'll see in a second that, it's got several names. You know, this is the Anglicization of, some Greek shit, right?
Orpheus. Okay, sure.
Yeah,
sure. Okay. So this is like a retelling of Orpheus.
Well, yeah, it's the British version.
Okay, great, sure.
So you got that. And then do you remember she falls asleep?
And a guy takes her, right?
Okay, well, when she awakes, she's like screaming and clawing her face, right? And then says... Yeah. That a guy, and you're getting close here, a guy visits her first, right?
Right.
And it's the, do you remember his name or his title? He's got a title.
No, I do not.
He's the king of the...
Vale?
Berries.
Oh, that's right. He's the fairy king.
He's a fucking fairy king. Yeah. So he's a badass. You know, this is like fae stuff. This is before fairy became like synonymous with a
Sure.
derogative homosexual shit. Yeah. Which is a
Sure.
shame. I think, you know,
Truly, truly.
bring fairy back as like some totally mystical shit that can ruin your life. You know,
I'm not gonna
like,
lie. The first, like, my knee-jerk reaction is a little sprite, like Tinkerbell, you know, clap, and they can grant wishes. Like, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. Let's see here. The next part, let's see. So at that point, then what happens? The king of the fairies visits and demands that she what?
Marries him, or
Yeah, something like that. Lives with him
goes with
forever.
him, to the Feywilds, to no doubt live a better life than she's living right now, hanging out with the
Exactly.
fairy folk,
And if
eating
she
berries and dancing in the woods. That sounds awesome.
100%. Let's see here. If she does not go willingly, she will be violently attacked and carried away. Right.
Right.
So Orfeo gathers his knights, but unfortunately, despite the fact that he's assembled like thousands of knights, they're not able to contain it and she disappears. Right.
Gone.
And then Orfeo takes this to heart. If you remember, he wanders the wilderness. He spends like 10 years wandering around.
I feel like that's a common trope amongst knights,
Oh,
that if they're such little crybabies, they lose one fight
yeah.
and then they wander the fucking woods for years. Like,
Yeah, but it's kind of like they're stripping off, you know, like there's a return to purity element that is, it's justly so a theme, but
or
maybe it's
just
lost relevance, you
learn to
know, here.
take the L. I don't
Yeah,
know, my
yeah.
guy.
Sure. So he lives there and he often begins to see the Lord of the Fairies on a hunt and like in
That's
different
right.
ways.
That's
Yeah, yeah,
right.
yeah. And then finally one day he sees.
Her.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. And he talks to her
And
and
remind me her name. It was
Herodotus.
Herodias. He sees Herodias,
Yeah.
and she leaves. I remember abruptly, but I don't remember what their interaction was.
Yeah, so he talks to her and she doesn't talk, and then finally she gets whisked away, right?
Right.
So at that point is kind of where we're going to join into the story, right?
Sure,
Like he
sure.
sees them heading towards a rock, is what we'd said, which is a mountain, right?
Okay.
And so that's going to be the beginning of the story. However, before we get into that, there is a matter that I want to get into, which we are doing no justice to, Jan, which is
Okay.
that this is a very musical thing.
Sure, there's harp going the whole time. Sure.
Exactly. And so I want to give you a sense of that that I don't think I gave to you before. Maybe I did touch upon it a little bit.
Yeah, I remember you opened with a little bit of the sing-songiness.
Okay. Yeah. So let me give
I'm
you
not
a
gonna lie,
little
I could have
more of
used with the
that.
harp. I love me a good harp.
Yeah, and so I may try to add that. And then I'm going to show you something that is telling for how these stories continue on and how they get added to throughout the years.
Okay. Okay.
That's pretty fun. But let me drop in the chat the text that I'm about to give you here. You got that
Yeah,
one?
oh yeah.
All right. So when he was in the Rashigo, well, 3 mile other mo, he come into a fair country as bright as sun on summer's day, smooth and plain and all green, hill no dales no there no seen, amid the land a castle you see, rich and real and wondery, all the utmost wall was clear and sheen as crystal, 100 tours there were about, they sleeves and batty heels out, the buttress come out the ditch of red gold, the artered rich, the vouser was out all of each manner, da vow small.
Oh man, well done, Marcel. Methinks someone practice.
Yeah, you know, the rhythm is unknown to us entirely at this point. You know, okay, these things could have been done in 100 million ways, 100 different ways. Here's something from the 1700s that it's the Gluck made this, which is a composer.
I'm sorry, the what?
His name was Gluck, G-L-U-C-K.
Talk about losing the name lottery.
Oh, yeah. You know, this kid was made fun of as a
child. He should have changed it. He should have just gone with something else. But you know what? I won't judge Gluck.
Don't judge Gluck. Mr. Gluck makes some beautiful music, honestly. And he's in the mid-1700s, so 18th century.
Okay.
I am picking this is because there's a resurgence of stuff related to Greek stuff. But instead of naming this Orpheus and Eurydice, right? He calls it Orfeo and Eurydice. And I think it kind of blends the two because there is a fucking harp in the middle of this. so I want you to listen to just a little bit of this. So you get a sense of what I think a audience a couple hundred years later was thinking about this and how it translates and affects music, you know?
Okay.
So here's a little bit of it.
Oh, bro, we got a flute in this bitch. Sure, I could totally see this casting a whole mood.
Right. And so, you know, the idea here, I think, is that, you know, imagine words over that, right? Over time, it became more orchestral, you know?
Sure.
And instead of the phrasing being done by a voice, it was done by the flute, right?
So, sure.
Like, whereas before you would have, a person talking, now you have a more sophisticated instrument that's also the flutes were around before, but not with all the mechanical lists.
Yeah, for sure. They were just more simple, almost like a recorder.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. You nailed it. So
gosh, what a good instrument a harp is. They're so rare today that when you actually see someone playing a harp, it's like that's a medieval instrument. That thing right there is old as shit.
Right. So, it's also a testament to, I think, the sophistication of engineering at the time.
Sure.
You know, they're difficult to make, you know, especially to make a good one. It does show that what the things they cared about too, you know, like that was important to them.
I did a project and person had a harp in their living room and I felt nervous being 5 feet around it.
Sure.
That's how like nice it seemed to me that it's like, no, that's no. It felt like standing around a very nice car. Where it's like, I do not want to scratch this thing because, oh boy.
Average cost of a nice one with pedals is like 20 grand. So, and then it goes up from there, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. So, they're precision instruments and they always have been. Yeah. So with that, we're going to get started. I am going to tell you that Orfeo is heading to the mountains and here we go.
Sure. Chasing his person.
His disappeared wife. Yeah.
It is his wife.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Great.
When he was in the rocky go, well, 3 mile or more, he came into a fair country as bright as sun on a summer's day. So when he had gone into the mountain, like 3 miles, he came into this fair spot.
Okay.
Smooth and plain and all green, hill nor dale, nor were they seen. So it was completely flat. Amid the land, a castle he saw, rich and real and wondrously high.
Okay, nice. So it's up on the rock. Great.
All of the outermost wall was clear and shine as crystal.
Whoa, it's a crystal castle?
It sure
Dude,
is.
Dude, we're in the Feywild. Hell yes. Yeah. Hell yes. All right.
And 100 towers there were about.
Okay. It's a big castle.
Yeah, and I love this word. It's dicely.
Dicely?
And battled stout. So dicely is a French word. It's old. And guess whose glossary it's actually in that I pulled it from as a definition, which means wondrous, like, even though it's widely available, but it's credited to somebody important that you know.
Robin
Jay?
Hood. No.
Jay? R?
R. Tolkien?
Yes,
okay,
sir.
Cool.
Yeah. So he makes an appearance in this podcast, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah.
He comes in and says, I knew that word. So, yeah. The buttresses, these are reinforcements of the castle. You might have noticed Notre Dame is like stacked. They call them flying buttresses.
Oh, yeah. They have like a little area underneath.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like these
like
arches.
A little cut out. Yeah, an arch.
Yeah, they make sure the walls don't fall over.
Yeah, sure.
That's good. Yeah.
They also just make it look dramatic.
Yes. Yeah, it's Gothic architecture. It's a telltale sign. So, and they're coming out of the ditch of red and gold and arched rich.
Okay. So it's a
pretty
fancy.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. The vaulting was all adorned of every kind of enamel.
Okay.
Jan.
What a weird flex.
It is. Do you want to hear about
enamel's
enamel?
On point. Oh, you know, that's what I'm here for.
Yeah.
I'm here for the sweet, sweet enamel talk.
Oh, man. So I'm going to give you.
I know what Marcel's Saturday night was.
A little bit of this. I'm not going to go too far. Okay. But because I can go far. But what it is in general, if you don't know what enamel is, it's a, which I'm sure everybody knows what it is, but they don't necessarily know how it's made. But it's a glass-like coating fused onto a metallic base. In a nutshell, that's what it is.
Sure.
How old is it? 13th century BC is the first place.
So it's been around for a minute.
It was found in Cyprus, which means it might even be older than that. They just found, you know, that's the oldest they found it in. There is a precious and semi-precious stones close. It's like a chemical bonding thing where they bond glass to a metal, typically gold. And then it went down the ranks, you know? So, as it became easier to do, it became seen with other items, right? Here's what I will tell you. Let me go to somewhere relevant in history, to this podcast. It's two paragraphs I'll give you. When Caesar conquered Britain, he found that the Celts were already using enamels.
Hmm.
So the Celts, by the way, amazing miners.
Hmm.
They're like dwarves, if you want
to. Sure, I was about to make that comparison.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah. They're
you
like
know
dwarves.
Where my brain goes.
Yep. Yep. Uh-huh. They were masters of jewelry and religion and textiles. They were really good at making clothes, too.
Two of those things are rad.
Yeah. The religion thing is tied to their jewelry, too. Because they believe they would make altars and figures and, you know, saintly things, which you've seen, you know, if you go to Europe, you know, what do they spend all their time and money on? Fucking churches everywhere.
Yeah, sure.
So, all right. So they were all around the British Isles. Very good examples still exist in the British Museum. There's a mirror in Gloucester found, a museum found in Birdlip in Gloucestershire with red enamel. They had used the Champlèvre technique, which... is a recession. This comes from, by the way, the Institute of Materials, Minerals and Mining, which is not an easy read.
That does not sound like a toe tapper.
I find myself in weird places on the internet. The enamel is polished flush with the divisions formed by the edges of the cells. Later Saxons hanging bowls found in the Sutton Hoo boat burial are some of the finest early Champlèvre work. In 9th century AD, this is getting closer to us,
sure.
Where the story is, Croissant technique enamels moved back into the Middle East in Byzantine Constantinople and a century later into Russia. The Byzantine style continued until the 12th century and usually comprised small thin pieces of gold, which were set into much larger objects. We've taken a huge regression, but just know that it'd be fancy, son.
Yeah, you know? Sure. It sounds real fancy. I'm having trouble envisioning like gold enamel on top of a crystal like thing with 100 towers. It's that typical medieval, like we're just over explaining a thing that isn't 100% thought out. It seems. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, that's, you know, well, okay. To that point, let's read the next line. The worst pillar that was to look upon was all burnished gold.
What a great. Yep. So the of all of these archway buttresses, the worst one was still the fanciest you've ever seen. Cool. Great.
All that land was ever light or ever covered in light.
Okay.
For when it should be dark and night, the rich stones light shone as bright as doth the noon sun shone.
Okay, so it's hard to look at because it's so damn reflective from all the golden crystal.
No man may tell nor think in thought the rich work that was there wrought. Sure. By all things him that think that is the proud court of paradise. So everybody thought it was paradise.
Yeah, sure.
By all,
and I mean,
that was
to fairies, it probably is.
Yeah. In this castle, the levities are light. And levities is our handsome gallant knight.
Okay.
So it's a word for like a handsome gallant young man. It doesn't exist anymore.
Strapping young lad. Yeah.
Or levity, probably in French. He wished to enter after if he might. So Orfeo knocketh at the gate.
Okay.
The porter was
I'm sure it hurt his hand because it's either made of gold or crystal, but sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The porter was ready thereat and asked what he would have do. Parfait, quoth he. And if you don't remember, parfait is like greetings, tidings.
Yeah, sure.
Or by my faith, right?
Sure.
I am a minstrel, lo. So he reveals himself. To solace thy lord with my glee, if it his sweet will be. So,
okay.
The porter undid the gate anon, which means quickly, and let him into the castle to go or gone. Then he gan behold about all and saw lying against the wall a folk that were thither brought. Okay, so he goes into the castle and he begins to look ever all around and he sees lying all around the walls folks that were brought. Okay.
So folks are
okay. Wait.
Okay.
A folk that were thither he brought and thought dead and ne'er not. So,
there they were people thought dead,
that
were, look dead but aren't.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So the castle is populated by just humans.
Okay. Yeah. Well, the next line is some stood without their heads.
Okay, sure. Yes. That's a hard thing for a human to do.
Yeah,
it's a hard, so, not impossible, but hard. Yeah. Very difficult. Yeah. Okay, so they look dead.
Yeah.
Some are missing their heads.
They're pretty dead.
But are still up and active.
Yeah, they're still alive.
Cool. Apparently. All right.
I don't know how you'd tell at a certain point.
I guess if he's like flipping a coin without a head, I'd be like, okay, wow, that guy's probably fine. He seems fine.
And some no arms had.
A problem, but you know, some people figure it out.
Yeah,
you get,
yeah, that's true.
You get those feet muscles
real strong. Yeah. And some through the body had wounds.
Okay.
And some lay woed, mad, and bound. They were like straitjacketed. That doesn't sound as bad. I don't know how they died.
Yeah.
And some armed on the horses set.
Okay. And by armed, we mean with a weapon or
armored.
Oh, okay.
Armed usually means armored. And then, sure. You know, once you're armored, nothing's a problem and everything's a weapon.
Yeah. you have become a weapon.
Yeah, sure. Totally. And some strangled as they ate, which means like choking.
Okay. So it's like the waiting room in Beetlejuice.
Yeah, it really is. I had a similar impression. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this one, I don't even know how they do it. And some were in water, drent, which means drowned.
Okay.
Are they in pools? Like, what is happening here?
Or are they just like laying on the ground, just coughing up water? Or like, yeah, that's, we'll go with one of those.
I don't know. And some with fire, all for shrant, which means, or for shrine, which means shriveled.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, some sure. Three-body problem. wives there lay on child bed, some dead and some awed. In here, awed means driven mad. So there was wives on child beds, some dead. So some were dead due to childbirth. Probably.
Okay. And which that's another hard one to do. This is a horror scene. I'd have to talk to a goddamn therapist after this. This is tough.
He's in for it, right? And let's see. And some dead, some awed. And wonder fell there, lay beside. So wondrous many lay beside, right as they sleep her undertides, just as they sleep at 3 a.m. I guess undertides is the closest I could come with. There's nothing really good there. I think that makes sense because 3 a.m. is supposed to be like a magical hour.
Hour, sure.
Yeah, it's a
that's
hour.
That's usually when the Dodger dogs hit the best.
Oh my god, yeah, danger dogs.
Exactly, them street dogs.
Mm. Oh my god, yes, yeah, 100%.
At like midnight, they're just not hitting as hard, you know.
No, I agree with you, and I seek them out at 2 to 3. I feel it's soaked in the proper amount of carbon from the cars on the road.
Enough really cops have been on there.
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
LA cuisine at its best.
It really is. You know, James was over and I gave him one also at like 2 a.m. when we're leaving a bar right downtown.
Yeah, of course.
Man, we destroyed those things.
Yep.
it's so well. And surprisingly, you know, for what it is, it's not that much money, you know.
Yeah, cheap, super cheap.
Yeah. Anyway. Okay. So each was thus in this world enum, which means taken. So each was taken. So this is them at their moment of their death. So it is like Beetlejuice, right?
Yeah, 100%. Sure.
I love this line. With fairy thither he come. So enchantment brought them here. You know, fairy magic brought them here.
Brought them here.
Yeah, which means people 700 years ago were like, fairies fucking have magic. Which means every time we play D&D, we're saluting those people.
There is an element of actual historical accuracy that D&D has, sure.
Yeah.
Now, I wonder, and I'm sure it's coming, why the fairies are like being weird, fetishistic, masochistic, like, oh, we just like to have a big group of people dying in our like fucking streets. We just, you know, it kind of sets the mood of the city.
Well, let me answer that a little bit. Okay. So what you have to know a little bit here, let me make sure I've got this tagged. Okay. Is, do you know what a romance is?
Oh, I've had a few in my life.
I love it. Do you know what the classical term in literature refers to?
I guess a story that's romantic.
No, you would think so. So, let's break down romance. Romance.
So a story about Romans?
Yeah. Okay. You got it. So a romance in classical literature is harkens back to tales from the Romans. Okay. Right. So the Romans had several different kinds of tropes that they loved to use. This is one of them, right? And in the what we begin to see in the later medieval era is that we begin to see the beginning of the Renaissance.
Sure.
And the Renaissance is the rebirth of the Roman and Greek kind of philosophy and ideas that they had, right? Sure. And so that is, this is kind of nodding towards that of appreciating the Romans and the Greek life. Now, in the Christian world, right, magic is kind of bad, right? Like, unless it's the power of Christ and it's like God magic, then it's fine.
Sure, then right? It's fine. Yeah, if if Moses is turning sticks into snakes,
right, right, we're all because cool. He works for the big man,
of
right?
Course. Yeah, he's got the right magic. Yeah.
Right, right, right. Everybody else is kind of, you know, bad, right?
Yep, sure.
Think Shakespeare. Think the Midsummer's Night Eve. Right.
Midsummer's Night Dream.
Dreams. Yeah.
I get to correct you on one thing. Yay.
Yeah. So the Midsummer's Night Dream, correctly stated, is a comedy, right? That harkens back to a lot of Roman trope and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure.
This
sure,
is kind sure. of that moment where they are saying, hey, there's a Hades.
Okay.
And because this is a story really of Orpheus, which our audience probably would have recognized, you know, it's like sure. coming from before them, even from the ancients. Sure. So all that to say, why can they get away with this? Because it harkens back to that type of idea that there's several kinds of afterlife.
Uh-huh.
And
sure.
you could find yourself in Hades, you know, and most people do, but not everybody does. Some people move on to greater things, right?
Okay. So, okay. Yeah. And it's just because a fairy stole you?
You know, I think this is just the fact that when you ask, it's a conflation, because sometimes our stories are very Christian, right?
Sure.
Yeah. This story conflates, pagan mythology, man. And it is what I would say is also a sign of reconciling these pagan stories into mm-hmm. a Christian understanding, as you'll see as the story continues to play out.
So you're telling me you're running a Hades entirely inside of your castle keep, on the streets, whole Hades right here.
Yeah, you know, because in the I think traditional stories, right? He actually journeys into the underworld. Yeah. Here he doesn't. He goes to this crystal castle, and that's supposed to be.
And there's a mini Hades there, Chinatown.
Huh? Yeah.
In most major cities.
Exactly, right. Because these people aren't in heaven; they're not in hell.
Yeah,
and that immediately is against what you would see in most Christian stories at this time. Sure. You know, they either go one way or the other. There might be a purgatory depending on what century we're in, you know. Sure. But, you know, they're trying to portray that, which is interesting. Like, why would you keep on to that? You know, and it's because I think they think it's interesting, you know, like death surrounds them in a lot of ways. Yeah. And also look at the number of deaths that they have, right? Like, these are some interesting deaths. There's a dude without head. Like, I could delve into this, you know, and I would look up other things just looking at the people that are there. And I wonder how many saints are kind of connected to this. But there's a dude without a head, a dude with no arms. There's people with wounds through their body. That one's more universal, right?
Sure.
Some lay crazy and bound. That one's weird to me. Like, I would want to go into that. Why is
yeah,
it?
Yeah. Why? I don't know.
You're dead? Yeah.
I don't think I've ever just heard about someone going nuts and dead. From going nuts. Yeah.
Right. You know, and then some are on horses and armored. That kind of makes it, they're like soldiers.
Yeah, but sure, sure.
You know, and some are strangled as like, was it that common?
That
people choked on their shit, I guess.
Hey,
I don't know.
That Heimlich, was it, saved countless lives.
Yeah. Or was it that it wasn't that common and, you know, they're just showing that as another thing that does happen though sometimes.
Sure, sure.
And
a
some
point
were
of interest, like
water drowned, you know, and then they do the opposite, which I love this because this becomes a literary move later that T.S. Eliot writes about and begins to analyze Ezra Pound to the Nazi guy He wasn't a great guy, but he had some good literary theories opposites and how they attract, like, because they put water next to fire, right? There's people that are drowning versus people that are covered in flames. And the humans love to juxtapose things like that, you know, like that's just a good literary trope. And then wives that lay on their childbed, some dead and some mad. What is, you know, that's common too, you know, and anyway. That's a whole paper right there.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
You could just focus on that and go to town, you know. Anyway.
You intellectuals always delving deeper than you should.
So anyway, there he saw his own wife, Dame Aratus, his lovely life, his dear life. Yep. So she was sleeping under an imp tree. I looked up imp tree. This is the only time they mention imp tree in history.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So it's a tree I've never seen before.
This is what it states on the internet. The fairy king steals the wife. So our Orfeo from under an imp tree, which was likely an apple cherry tree. The placement of imp tree has been interpreted as a representation of human interpretation, but the exact meaning of the term has been debated.
Okay. Okay. I'm going with the weeping willow because it's more dramatic.
Oh, man, let's do that. Yeah, that's
just
so
a
close.
Beautiful tree. Love me a weeping willow. Okay, so he sees her just laying under what we're retconning to be a weeping willow. And same place
All the... It's literally the next line. You know. Yeah, I don't know where. I thought we were in a hall looking with these people, but she's sleeping under an imp tree. By her clothes, he knew well that it was she.
Okay, that's weird that that's what drew him to that conclusion, but okay, great. I know her by her shoes.
That's her Nikes. Yeah. And when he had beheld these marvels all, he went into the king's hall. Then saw he there a seemly sight. Seemly means
Hold
fair.
Up. Yeah. So sorry.
Yeah.
He's on a quest,
I guess,
to save his wife.
Yep.
Or at least get her, whatever. He sees her.
Yep.
I'm just gonna put a pin on that side quest and go into the hall. Why doesn't he? Wouldn't you think,
Jan? It's a cutscene, bro. You have no control.
But a cutscene where, like, what, is there a fence between them? Why wouldn't he just go talk to her? Like, hey, we should probably bounce from this place unless you're into this, which, you know, we'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. Definitely a plow. Well, I don't know. So then saw he there a seemly sight, a tabernacle blissful and bright. So tabernacle is a sanctuary, like a shrine that's erected. It can be small. It can be fancy. It can be a building, apparently.
Okay.
So it can be a lot of things. All right. In this case, it looks like it's a bigger thing.
Sure.
You know, like maybe a building, tent, canopy, maybe an actual structure. So
made of crystal. Okay.
Yeah, it's unclear because it's
some sort of shrine.
Story.
Right.
Therein her master king sat, and her queen fair and sweet. Her crowns, her clothes shine so bright that aneath behold him he might. So he could scarcely behold them. So he could scarcely see them.
Little tacky, but it's fine.
Yep. When he had beholden everything there, he kneeled down before the king. O Lord, he said, if it thy will were, my menstruacy thou shouldst hear. So you shall hear my songs. Right? He's like, let me rock your socks off. The king answered, what man art thou? Thou art hither he coming now. No, none that is with me, nor one that is with me, has never sent after you. Since you're here and I am enrained, I have never seen such a foolhardy man who has dared to come to us unless I wished him summoned.
Okay, so the fairy king was like, yo, people don't come here unless I ask.
Yeah, and yeah, sure. It is written in fucked up English, so I am heavily paraphrasing. If you want the original old English, it's "Siden de each regne gan, inofo never so fo hardy man, that hitherto aus der swende, but that each him wild of sender."
So, okay.
Yeah.
I caught the last bit.
Caught it all, I'm sure.
I'm sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'll skip those in the future just because they're...
No. I mean, occasionally they are...
they're little gems. Yeah. Lord, he said, believe you full well, I am nothing but a poor minstrel. And okay. Sir, it is the manner of ours to seek many a lord's house, that we may not, even though we may not be welcome in, yet we must offer forth our glee.
Okay, so even though you showed up to the party without an invitation,
you got it.
We're gonna let you chill because we're that cool. Yeah,
No, it's the other way around. He's telling them.
I understand that they. Okay,
But you got the gist of it. You just got the people wrong.
Hey,
right?
Just because I don't got an invitation doesn't mean I can't. Yeah,
right. Our people come to rich lords' houses and just play because that's who we are, man.
Bro, you can't. This harp plays where and when it wants. Yeah. I am a vessel for the harp.
Yes, I must offer my glee wherever I go. Well, who, you know, it really is kind of, I think they nailed that character well in The Witcher.
Bard, the,
which I'm blanking on his name, sure. Which is going to kill me and I'm going to remember it.
Marcel Bard, do I know?
Yeah. Oh, shit. Oh, it's biting my tongue. We'll have to come back to it, but got it.
Toss Barty McBardface.
Yeah. I mean, I played so many of those games. All right. So many hours. It's a flower.
This whole podcast is about to get derailed.
Okay. Fuck it. I got to look it up. Bard and Witches. This is going to kill me too.
And the name is?
Well, it's Jaskier, but that's like his real name. What's his Bard and Witcher name?
Because the name wasn't good enough. You're like, no.
No. Dandelion. Motherfucker, it's Dandelion. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Nobody knows him as Jaskier or Jaskier. But anyway. Okay. So before the king, he sat down and took his harp and began to play so merry a sound.
Bro, is he about to win this boss battle with some sweet, sweet harping?
And he tempered his harp or tuned his harp as well he can, and blissful notes there began to ran.
Okay, good. That, he's laying down some sick, sick harp.
That in all the palace, everyone came forth to hear and lieth down to his feet.
Wow.
Yeah. They thought that his melody was so sweet. The king listened and sat full still to hear his glee. The king had goodwill.
Natty 20.
Great pleasure he had of his glee. The rich queen also had a she. When he had stopped his harping, then he said to the king, said to him the king. So the king is talking to him.
Of course.
Sure. Minstrel, I liketh well thy glee. Glee, if you haven't picked up, kind of means song, right?
Yeah, sure.
Now ask of me whatever you wish.
Dang. Generously. Just crushed it.
Yeah. Generously, I will pay. Largely, she shall pay. Now speak and tell might a say. So you might find out what, I can get you, right?
Sure.
So, sir, he said, I beseech thee that thou would givest me that same levity, bright of complexion. So the same amazing person that slept under the imp tree.
Okay.
And what do you think the king said?
Oh, bro. This could go one of two ways.
Yeah.
Where he slaps Orfeo on the back and goes, kid, you got moxie. I don't like a guy who goes big. Or No, or genie rules, right? I think since he's Faye, he's going genie rules, where he's gonna give it to him, but it's got some strings attached.
Okay, I like that.
Harp joke, intentional.
Okay, I like it. Nay, quoth the king, so quoteth the king, that could never be. A ill-matched couple are you both together, for you are lean and rough and black, and she is lovesome without lack.
Whoa, who are you thing. To say? Who are you to bring in your fucking predisposed bullshit into our little relationship? You don't know us.
Yeah, and is he black?
I was like,
is race coming into this?
Over
yeah,
that,
yeah.
Is I just assumed
another paper was, Jan?
Yeah, I mean, truly, yeah. I assumed he was talking about like a spirit or some shit. But if I it's a race a thing, it. It's another. Oh boy,
a loathly thing it were for thee to sin her in thy company. So, you know, to see her together with you. Oh, sir, he said, gentle king. Yet it were a more fouler thing, so more disgraceful thing, to hear a lie from your mouth. So, sir, as you said just now, whatever I might ask for, I should have. And by necessity, thou must hold your word. The sure, king said, yeah. Since it is so, take her by the hand and go. Of her, I wish that you be happy. He kneeled down and thanked him quickly. He is kind of weird here, so I don't know if it. I'm guessing it's a. It seems like given what's next, it's Orfeo. Yeah. His wife he took by the hand and did him swift out of that land and went him out of that country, right as he come the way he had went. So long he hath the way he had taken to Winchester, he has come. That was his own city.
Good to know. Good.
Yeah. And no man knew that it was he, no further than the town's end. For because he did not want to be recognized, but as a beggar, he built a full Narwi, which here. It's a difficult phrase. People don't really know how to translate it. Even the editor literally says is a difficult phrase. So here it's literally he didn't want to be recognized, but as a beggar, it's unknown here. You know, he built full Narv. It's a difficult phrase there. He took his harbor, so his safety.
Okay, sure.
So I don't know if that means it's a difficult phrase, as in it's literally a difficult phrase, or that's what it translates. Sure. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So I don't know.
Either way, homeboy, my boy Orfeo, gets his wife. I guess slings her over his shoulder because she's not communicating to him. Or he takes her by the hand, goes back the way he came. Gets back to Winchester, goes, hey, we got to lay low for some reason, so we're going to be beggars.
Yeah.
Crazy. All right, great.
Yeah, continue. That's 100%. Yeah, to him and his own wife as a minstrel of poor life, so kind of like lower life, and ask tidings of the land, so I guess he's begging, and sure. Who the kingdom held in hand. The poor beggar in his cottage told him ever the pover began in his cottage told him every scrapped how their queen was stole away 10 years ago with fairy, so magic, right? And right. How her king was went into exile, but no one knew in the entire country, and how the steward had gained hold of the land, and other many things that he had told him, right? So remember how he had put the steward into control?
Yeah, sure.
Right. So
he's coming back. He hasn't taken the throne back, but just found out about what's been happening there. Opening scene of, well, not opening, but early scene of the Sandman. He returns and he's like, oh shit.
Yeah, exactly. And I think he's asking around and who the kingdom held, right?
Sure.
And so that's where he figures out. Yeah, kind of like what you said. Yeah. Sure. And so the next day, towards noon, he made his wife stay with the beggar. Right, so he made his wife there abide. The beggar's clothes he borrowed anon. And
I like how she hasn't said a word.
No, she's, like, you know.
She is a prop in this story.
She's a
trophy. She might as well be a sword. Yeah, I mean, she might as well be a trinket of some sort. Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely does not pass the Bechdel test.
The Bechdel test, sure, yeah.
And he hung his harp upon his back, and he went him to that city, that men might behold him and see earls and barons bold. Burgesses and levies him gun behold. So all these important people can see him. Lo, they said, such a man, how long the hair is upon him. So long hair, I guess, is bad here. Lo, how his beard hangeth to his knee.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he is clungen like a tree. So he's gnarled like a tree.
Sure.
So he's like, you know, there. Big old long wild beard man.
Looks, yeah, sure.
And as he went into the street with his steward, he began to meet. And loud he set on him a cry. So he, Orfeo, on the steward, right? Sir Steward, he said, merci. I chamano para of Hartenis. So I am from heathendom. Help me now in this distress. The steward said, come with me, come. Of that, what I have, thou shalt have some.
Wow. What a nice little guy. Hey.
Every good harper is welcome to me for my lord's love, Sir Orfeo.
Right. Dude, that's the setup back then. Being a minstrel, bard's the best class in D&D. This is just proving
that's 100%.
This is totally proving it.
Every single time, man. Yeah. It doesn't pass without fail. Yeah. In the castle, the steward sat at meat. Now, meat here means board or table.
Okay.
Yeah, which is interesting if you think about
it. Yeah, sure.
Where meat comes from. Anyway.
And many we meet there, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. And many lording was by him seated. There were trumpers and troubadours. So trumpeters and drummers. Tabors, sorry, not troubadours. Harpers fell. And crowders. So many harpers and many string players, which are crowders.
Okay.
Much melody they made all. So there's like a full fucking band, dude.
Band, yeah, dude. Like there's off. Like a small orchestra forming.
Yeah. And so, Orfeo sat still in the hall and hearkeneth. When they been all still, he took his harp and tuned it loudly or tempered it chill. The blissfulest notes he harped there that ever any man heard with ear.
Dang. Orfeo just is crushing this adventure. Off to a rough start, but at this point he is on fire.
Each man liked well his glee. The steward beheld this and began to say that he knew the harp at once. Minstrel, he said, if you wish to thrive, where did you get this harp and how? Pray that you tell me now. Lord, said he, in an unknown land, I went into a wilderness as I went, and there I found it in a dale or a valley with lions torn, with lions who had torn a man into small pieces and wolves that had devoured him with teeth so sharp. By him, I found this harp. Well, 10 years ago, it was.
Okay, so he's setting up that he took the harp from King Orfeo and is now but some beggar. And for some reason, he needed to bring two different families of monster or beast. A lion had killed him, I could tell.
Yeah,
and then totally, the wolves ate him.
The wolves ate him, yeah.
Trust me, I could tell. He didn't die because of a wolf. No.
Not the way he was laying.
If you look at the blood spray, the blood spray is actually far closer to a lion attack. Just, are there lions in this part of the world? No. But one of them was out. One of them was here.
Yeah. Like I told you, my favorite part was looking at British at one point, because I was like, were lions in the England? And I saw alien lions. Do you remember this?
Yes. Yeah.
And then it turns out alien just means foreign over there. Like they used it. And I was so amped for alien lions.
A lion in a spacesuit. Space. Yeah, that's incredible.
I should have known better. Anyway. Oh, quoth the steward, now me is woe. That was my lord, Sir Orfeo. So,
yeah. Good. Yep.
Yeah, alas, wretch, what shall I do that I have lost such a lord lately? Woe that I was born, that him was so hard, a bitter fortune was allotted, and so vile a death befell him. Let's see. Down he fell and swooned to the ground, so he fainted. Mm-hmm. The dude here and his barons took him up in that moment and told him how it went. There's no remedy for man's death is what they told him. There's no bot of man's death.
Sure.
So, you know, everybody dies.
Yeah.
King Orfeo knew well by then his steward was a true man and loved him as he ought to do. And he stood up and said thus, "Lo, steward, hearken now this thing. If each were Orfeo, I am Orfeo the king, and had suffered very long ago in wilderness much sorrow, and had won my queen away out of the land of fairy, and had brought the levity, the gracious lady here, right here to the town's end, and with a beggar here had placed her, and were myself here to come in poverty to thee, the still, for to test you and your goodwill."
So that's why he set up that lion, then immediately told them.
"And I found thee thus true.
Dang.
Okay. Thou should never regret it. Surely, for love or fear, thou shouldst be king after my day."
Okay, so he's giving him, for reacting properly, he's giving him kinghood after he dies.
Well, we'll see, but...
Okay, sure. Yeah, sure. He's saying it.
"But if you had been happy of my death, thou should have been banished immediately."
That is some gaslighting. That's some shit. Orfeo took came down a few notches there in my book, because that's some manipulative nonsense.
It's pretty manipulative, you know. I don't know how you can reconcile that in any positive way, you know.
It's not great.
Other than, I mean, it just speaks to the time, right? Like, tests are a thing that people did, you know. People underwent, especially a day before cameras and all that stuff. So I don't know. You know, there's also just a hint of, like, you can't believe who's what anybody necessarily acts like when you're not there.
Sure.
Because you live in a time where you don't know, you know, like nothing is recorded really in the same way, you know.
Still, I wouldn't even blame him after 10 years.
Yeah.
After 10 years, I wouldn't, if you told me, if I was in his shoes and heard, oh no, he got eaten by a lion and wolves, I'd be like, oh shit, that's what happened to him? Fuck, man. Oh, that's, like, I wouldn't cry about it. Like, yeah, I get, I don't, this is all a little tough. It reminds me of things Dr. Doom would do.
Yeah.
There's a couple of Dr. Doom stories where he fucks with the Latverian council in the same way. It,
And then all those that were seated therein recognized that it was Sir Orfeo. And the steward him.
So everyone just has a, oh, it's him.
Yep. Okay. And the steward him well knew. He overturned the table there and threw it on the ground and fell down to his feet in front of Sir Orfeo. So did every lord there that was seated. And all they said at in one cry was, "You are our lord, sir, and our king." Huh? Glad they were that he was alive. And they led him to his chamber immediately and bathed him and shaved his beard.
Okay.
And attired him as a king openly.
Cool.
And then afterwards, with great procession.
I think kings can have beards, but that's just me.
No, Jan. No. They must be shaved beards. Yeah. And immediately, with great procession, they brought the queen into the town. With all manners of minstrelsy, again, you know, music. Lord, there was great melody. Cool. For joy, they wept with their eyes.
Good to know it wasn't with their butts.
I couldn't make that up.
Good to know. Yep, that's good.
For joy, they wept with their eyes.
It's like it was written by a toddler. Yep, good.
They had... there's a footnote here. They saw Orfeo and Herodotus return in safety, and now King Orfeo was newly crowned, and his queen, Dame Herodotus, lived long afterwards. And after that, the king was the steward.
Okay.
So everybody gets a happy ending, dude. Everybody lives great.
And she, I mean, we got so little development about the trauma. I mean, truly, what's her name again? Sorry, I keep...
Herodotus?
Herodotus. Uh-huh. I keep thinking of Herodotus.
Sure.
Herodotus has no development here. She's truly the most interesting person in this story. She got... kidnapped and held in a form of Hades in like a sub pocket of hell for 10 years. The fucking mental damage that would do. I just can't wrap my head around the fact that we don't get outside of she lived a long and probably terrible life after that. Wow. Okay. Okay. And that's, is that it? That's the ending?
No, I got one more paragraph here.
Okay.
Harpers in Britain after then heard how this marvel began and made hereof a lay of good liking, of good delight. So they made this lay, this harping song, and named it after the king that lay Orfeo is called. Good is this lay, sweet is the note.
Sure.
Thus comes Sir Orfeo out of his sorrow. God grant us all well to fare. Amen.
Of course it ends with an amen. Of course. Okay. Correct me if I'm wrong, but the Greek version.
Yeah.
And truly, I only know I'm not like going to pretend like I have ever read the actual story or anything. My understanding of Orpheus comes from the Sandman. I'm almost certain in that tale, it's a lot more fucked up of an ending because he's given like a challenge by Hades to not turn around, and then sets the Furies, I think they're called, after him, and then they rip his head off. And it ends grimly. Whereas this tale is a happy-go-lucky, everyone wins, the fairy king's defeated by a song, which, truth be told, I actually dick that. I just would have figured he would have done. Fairies to me are a lot more tricky, right? I would have figured he would have done some tricky business. Some like, oh, you could get her, but she won't talk for the rest of this story, which I guess that that just kind of happened anyway. But
yeah, no, it's a good thing. Let's make that clear. There's okay. So the story comes to us from the great Roman poets Virgil and Ovid. There's a couple of virgins, many virgins
too. There's a few in there.
Yeah. So Orpheus, is a skilled musician, right? That part's known, right?
Yeah, sure.
A couple of different ways that this goes in this ends that I've heard of, but essentially Orpheus's wife dies a tragic death, right? Like usually she's, you know, bit by a snake, something like that,
sure.
Right? Okay. She, which is kind of fucked up, but you know, it happens.
Yeah, sure.
Orpheus filled with grief, he can't accept the loss. He finds his way to the underworld. He has his musical charms. He defeats several people with his musical might, right? Total sure, D&D bard shit.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
You know, Cerberus shows up. Persephone, Hades, they're all there. They weep when he plays his music. They agree to it. He doubts the deal. Inevitably turns back to look at her, which is not part of the deal, right? She's coming out of the tunnel to the land of the living. And then in some places, he's left to deal with that. Like that trauma that he can never have back.
He just lost her. Okay.
And some of them, some of the female followers, the Maenads, tear him to pieces, except for his head, which continues to sing until eternity.
And that's why in The Sandman, Morpheus visits Orpheus's head, but he's not singing. So that's Neil. We've got some notes for Neil Gaiman.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, that's one version of it.
Yeah, of course.
It's a wildly popular story.
Sure, sure.
So much so that it exists, in written form, which is rare. You know, any of these stories that exist in written form after these many years is there. So let me give you what our wonderful editors, whom I told you I would tell you later who they are.
Oh, I can't wait.
Anne Laskaya and Eve Salisbury. Yeah, so
and
I mentioned
Eve Salisbury. Okay, right.
Creator of The Stakes. I'm sure that's never been said of her. Let's see here. What our editors, amazing editors, have to say about Sir Orpheo? The Auchinleck manuscript, a tremendously important anthology dating from around 1330 to 1340, contains the earliest known Middle English version of Sir Orpheo. So you're getting the straight out the tap version.
Okay, great.
As you can tell, ending way happier than the classical Greek, as you rightly pointed out.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody wins. Yeah, this is a total like, I think what it is what I was alluding to earlier, which this is kind of like a more Christian ending. You know, they fucking Disneyfied it.
Yeah, truly. They took out the somber, like, the fact that the OG story is a bummer. It's, right. Yeah, it's complicated, right?
Right. Instead, he takes her out of essentially hell, but it's not hell. It's like a fairy king. But then they show hell. You know, there's like dead people everywhere. Yeah. Like when I think fairies these days, I think like, you know, bubble sculptures and shit like that. You know, like weird.
Sure.
Shit like
I guess
that.
I still have. Because and we're going
the Feywild,
and we're going deep into D&D nerddom, but fairies are in the monster manual, right? They're considered a type of monster, though they look fair and fun. They're mischievous. They're little assholes. They have ill intent. So I can get along with that. That's like. Sure, they're fairies, but they're fucked fairies. What I guess, like, not that I'm having trouble with, but rather that I'm it's not going down that easily, is the idea that there wasn't any consequence for Orpheo getting that he just beat the boss. So often it's like, again, genie rules,
right? Right.
Okay,
right.
You wish for $1 million, but you get it, but at the same time, the U.S. currency collapses. Ooh, fucking, you know, genies, you can't trust them. You're going to get something, but it's not going to be what you want, right? I want to be the smartest man in the world, and everyone else dies.
Right.
Now so, you're the smartest man in the, you know. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, 100%. But there's a retconning on this, right? Like,
sure.
They are whitewashing it for a reason, which I think part of it is what I mentioned earlier, the appreciation for a pagan society, but trying to reconcile that with your own ethos, which is sure. moving more and more Christian and more anti anything else that isn't.
Sure.
You know? So anyway, to go back to the editors, the manuscript, not anyway, those are really good talking points, man.
Yeah, of course,
you know,
course.
I think that's really worthy to consider. And it also shows you, you know, that move to Disneyfy things and to change a classical story to what you want it to be is actually really fucking old.
Oh yeah, that we've been doing remakes,
right,
for as long as society has existed. We've just been, we like that story. That there's that Kurt Vonnegut like masterclass on storytelling, and he breaks down Snow White. And he
oh
just,
yeah,
like,
there you
if
go.
If you want to make $1 million, boy, do I have a story for you.
Right.
So it starts with a young girl, and that we've just been redoing these stories in for modern audiences forever. I'm just surprised. I guess if because I don't think I would last a day in the medieval times. I don't think I would get to sundown before I'd be like, all right, I'm out. I'm out.
I don't know. I think you would find, you know, I mean, I don't know how much these stories depict real medieval life, you know?
Well, and that's, I get where I was going with that is that, I guess if your day-to-day life was kind of shit, you would want a toe tapper. You would want something where you were walking away from that harp session, that harp bard ballad. You would want a good story. You would want the happy ending. You would want that.
Yeah, but remember, we had the Chaucer stories, you know, where people are kissing each other's assholes and stuff, and you know, waiting for the fake flood. You know,
yeah, sure.
That is a whole subset of stories that may or may not have survived history that got told. That shows that people at this era also, like, yeah, there's this, but this shows that there's some staunchy people. It inevitably means that there were people not acting like this. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. And there were people that were far more, I think, in line with what you would agree with. Although that is a thing of just pure speculation and debate at a certain point, you know, I mean, I'll tell you this. We can tell you a lot in medieval culture about like where people lived. We can tell you a lot about like the materials they had available to them. Right. And the types of technologies that they probably had, although that's starting to get a little loose. And then when you get into like what they actually valued and what day-to-day life was like, really hard to get into that because you cannot preserve that. You know, there's no writing wasn't sophisticated enough. It's not like, you know, like if people are somehow able to maintain the digital grid that is the Matrix and like, or the internet, and then put that, you know, 1,000 years from now and analyze that, they're going to have a pretty good idea of what our humor is and isn't.
Yeah, you know? Sure. Well, we've also documented so much of the minutia of life.
Exactly.
Where it seems like outside of talking about fucking gold plated enamel, they didn't really, it seems like they didn't find the minutia that interesting, which I get. Again, if you're working hard, this is why Marvel movies and Disney does so well. You want to go to a place, you want to feel good, You want a happy ending. You want everyone smiling at the end. And then you want that da 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 da. And then credits roll. And then you go fuck off to your experience, which, you know, not all of it is bad, clearly. But yeah, the elements of. I understand why they changed the story. It's far less sophisticated. Which feels weird being that much later in time. I like a bummer ending. I do like a bummer ending. There's something fresh about it. Every time I hear like, oh no, it ends fucked. It's like, oh, that's unique. Yeah, because so much stuff is Disneyified.
Yeah. And I think well, I mean, I agree with what you're saying. I think the takeaway from this particular story is that there's just a variety of ways that medieval people were grasping with different ethos and what that meant for them. Sure. That would eventually alight to individualism and humanism, you know, and that's what called back to Roman and Greek stories that focused on suffering, which is what you're boarding on.
Yeah, sure.
Are kind of good at, right? Like, so eventually in the Renaissance, that kind of stuff, you know, the, just like I was mentioning, the comedies come back, but so do the tragedies, you know, sure. And Shakespeare comes back, Chaucer, and they write some fucking bangers, you know, about,
I mean, they still tragedy. Teach them in high school.
Yeah. You know, and that's just in Europe. You know, one time we're going to have to start to branch out to some of the other Renaissance.
Oh, dude, that would be very interesting. Yeah. Medieval China, I'm sure, is fucking wild.
Oh, dude, some of their stories are cool. They have these cyclical stories that go on. They're like the Decameron, which we'll get into. It just became an Amazon series, so I'm staying away from it. Part of me kind of wants to dig into it to look at some of the original source material versus how the show did it, but that's kind of outside the scope of our podcast in some ways, you know.
Sure, sure.
We're not really a visual media, you know, and and I don't want to spar with anybody also, you know, like they're doing their best. You know, we could look at some of the text. I don't speak Italian. So that's a thing. I am learning French. So I'm going to get better at these French ones. So because French hasn't changed much at all over the years. I'll tell you that they even have
very French.
Yeah, they have a society, literally a government agency that determines what words can be added to the lexicon, and they have to be French. So like the computer, you know, they have a word for it. It's ordinateur, which is different from like computer, which everybody fucking else just took the American
word.
Yeah,
just took the, sure.
No, that's not French, dog. Yeah, the cell phone is not a cell phone, although they call it a cell phone informally, but it's le portable. So, you know, like the portable. So why did that become? I don't know. You know, but they have a society that literally, like a government agency,
governs their language. Yeah, cool.
to continue, what our esteemed editors, once again, I'll give you their names real quick because they did a lot of work. And Laskaya and Eve Salisbury, they did amazing. And they further write. The manuscript was apparently compiled for affluent but non-aristocratic readers.
Okay.
So take that as
middle
you will.
Class.
Yeah. We're in the 1300s.
Sure. You know? So it's hard to figure out what a middle class is at that point. Sure.
It really is. It includes a wide variety of materials, many of which are extant only in this manuscript. All the texts of the Akhenolach are in English. The manuscript provides considerable information on literacy and book production in the early 14th century, and it has received particular attention because there is some evidence which suggests that Chaucer may have owned this book.
Huh. So the big boys looking back at good old Orfeo.
Yeah. Yeah. The author of Sir Orfeo is unknown.
Wow. So yeah, just lost to
the
ages.
100%. Wow. Yeah, no idea. Earliest Middle English, you know, because here's the thing. England is kind of at this point, fucking shit hole, you know, like nobody wants to go there. You know, you might go there to unload some stuff, to get some medals, jewelry, maybe.
Kind of like today. Am I right?
Brexit. Yeah. Fuck y'all.
All right.
Yeah. The language of the text suggests that it was composed in the late 13th or early 14th centuries with the Westminster Middle Essex area. No immediate source for the poem is known. Most scholars assume that an old French source existed at one time. Gone. Yeah. Uh-huh. References to musical lay of Orpheus can be found in several old French texts. So they have secondary information. People sure. talk about it.
Okay.
There's primary in history and then there's secondary, right? This sure. is a secondary source. So we know of it. Old French text, 12th century romance, Flore et Blanc-Fleur refers to Le Lay d'Orphée. So the Lay de l'Espine mentions Le Lay or Le Son d'Orphée. So again, you know, the Orphean Lay. So it's like a song that's kind of popular somewhere, sometimes, sure. maybe. In the 12th century, so that means as early as 1100s, this shit wow. was banging around.
Wow. Yeah,
which would mean it's more, you know, like 800, 900 years ago, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, that's nuts. Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe people just want a happy ending.
Oh, totally. Right. Totally.
They're like, life sucks. You know, like, I just want to hear something happy. Yeah, once, dude. He goes away with them. We fixed it. The story yeah. is cool. Oh, my God. This is a way better ending than the last
That's
one.
That's why the fucking Minions are a fucking billion-dollar franchise. Right. I mean, what the
That's
fuck
a good
are you
analogy.
Talking about? We fucking love a story where everyone's smiling at the end. Goddamn.
Yeah. Some scholarly efforts have been made to find connections between Sir Orfeo and a number of other texts, including Boethius de Constantia Philosophie, which I do know. We could cover it. It's an interesting philosophy book, but I don't know how good a podcast an interesting philosophy book from
will
the
be.
Middle
yeah,
Ages
sure.
will be.
Sure.
It is not easy reading. Sure. And it is, you know, ooh. It's cool. It's all about suffering. Boethius... it was a formational text at the time. Like, this is one of the things that got taught in school over and over and over. This shit got hit in the head for me. But essentially, Boethius, the idea of the Wheel of Fortune really comes to
sure.
Credence
the
here.
Tarot card, right?
Yep,
yeah,
you got it. And sure. so he was very rich. There was an overthrow of the government. He was put in prison. His family was killed off and he was going to be executed. He writes a philosophy talking about how times change. And like, even if you do everything right, things can still go wrong.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and that's something that resonates throughout all history, right?
Sure.
He was like, I was loyal. What is loyalty when I'm now being held in prison for treason?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, you know, like, why should I be held in prison for treason? Because I didn't serve that guy. I served my guy, but now I'm here. And oh man.
Because that guy changed.
You know, and the real philosophy. I mean, it's a pivotal piece. It's really good. It was written about 500 AD. And you
wow,
know, I mean,
so that's fucking old. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's back there, man. You know, it's at the collapse of the Roman Empire. But it sets quite a bit of European philosophy, even reasons why you should, you know, overthrow somebody or, you know, I mean, people make cases off of it left and right through history, almost the moment it's written, you know, for why their actions are justified or why they're the victim, you know. None of these are conclusive. What is certain is that Sir Orfeo presents a Briton lay on a classical theme. That's all we can tell. That's it. The Orpheus myth is, of course, well known throughout the Western world, whether as a lover, musician, or priestly wisdom figure. Orpheus can be found represented in ancient Greek art and literature from as early as the 6th century BC.
Wow.
That's how old that story is. Let
yeah,
that
sure.
sink in.
Yeah, sure.
2,600 years ago.
We've been telling that fucking banger for a while. Yeah.
Yeah, and you knew it before we even fucking read this shit because you saw it in other stories, you know?
Yeah, sure. Like, yeah, to be fair, yeah, it was mixed into a story,
sure.
but yes, yeah.
Yeah, but that means 2,600 years ago, somebody that lives now was like, you know what's cool, bro?
Was entertained yeah, by exactly. the same concept, yeah.
And the narrative can be found in a number of different ancient cultures. Orpheus is also well represented by authors known to the medieval world, including Virgil, Ovid, Horace, Boethius, the anonymous figure of a Hellenistic Jewish Testament of Orpheus, Clement of Alexandria, Fulgentius, and later William of Conches, Nicholas Trivet, Boccaccio, who wrote the Decameron, the anonymous author of the Ovid Morales, Pierre Berussier, Christian de Pizan, and Robert Henderson, just to name a few, the author's name dropping here clearly. The power of the Orpheus myth to resonate throughout time and within both classical and medieval literatures has led to a number of divergent interpretations of the Lay of Sir Orfeo that has been read within Christian contexts, Celtic folktale contexts, as well as when, within historical, philosophical, psychological, intertextual, and poetic contexts.
Okay.
So it's been studied.
Yeah, right? No shit.
Let's go down to the last part here. As with many Breton lays, this narrative recreates folklore motifs. The journey to the other world, the man who loses his wife lover, the rash boon, the exile return pattern, and the testing of the loyal steward. The lay creates a double narrative in which the loss of queen precipitates the loss of the kingdom, and the private recuperation of the queen precipitates the public recuperation of the kingdom. It has often been noted that the poem structure is built upon antithesis, loss and restoration, sorrow and joy, wealth and poverty. That's that duality I was telling you about. Sure. You know, that later, you know, early turn of the century, people who began to look at literary analysis as important and catalog stories began to notice trends, right?
Mm-hmm.
Jung jumps out at this, you know, eventually. The calm beauty, archetypes, you know. Calm beauty of the lush warm garden and the grief of the stark, cold, or indifferent wilderness, the elegance of the fairy world and the macabre tableau of the death courtyard, the brutality of nature and the civilizing force of art. But contrast is also problematic. More than one scholar has noticed the way the eerie other world seems to mirror the medieval court world of the poem. And more than one scholar has examined the oppositions with a deconstructive term. Even the task of interpreting the major characters unravels a plethora of possibilities. The Fairy King, for example, abducts Herodotus, but he is not overtly identified as evil in the poem. Instead, he operates outside and beyond the human framework of understanding. He can be read as a demonic figure, particularly if we invoke a medieval Christian framework, but evoking other frameworks will produce other readings. He can serve as an image of fate, a representative of death, an adversary of who comes to life to punish a sin, a pre-Christian divinity or spirit, a rupture in meaning, the representative of artifice, irrationality, king of textuality, and more. You know, like,
yeah,
people have really pulled on the edges on this.
Yeah.
And that's where I want to end it, kind of with the, you know, the editor's very, very erudite study of this thing. You know, great job to them.
Yeah, 100%. No, I was just going to say, I did like how chaotic the king was, because he definitely comes across as, I mean, he's just stealing people after giving them maddening visions. And then later on is like, I mean, bro, you play some good harp. You can get your wife back. That's fine. Like, it's such a, who is this guy?
And then he's like, no, you can't have your wife back. And he's like, but you told me. And he's like, all right.
I am a fucking demon of my word.
Yeah. So strange. So.
All right.
Sir Orfeo.
Yeah. If you've listened this far, you have literally heard us ramble for too long. I love every single one of you except you, Greg. Except you.
Yeah, fuck you, Greg.